afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castile. My guest in the studio today, Neil Oriens, was born outside Chicago, raised, spent his growing up years in Omaha, Nebraska, and then attended the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, and then went on to receive his BFA in printmaking at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. Christy Lickey, if you're listening, there's a fellow Nebraska fan there of the university. It's interesting. Today, I thought that we were going to just be discussing visual art with Neil, but the more that I continue to research him, I do want to say he is a guest teaching artist for this month, actually, at the Delta Grand Theater in Opelousas for their young people's art camp that they do there. And the more that I started researching and finding out about Neil, it's like, oh my gosh, the guy writes. And through his writing, I discovered that he very much is into music, and to the point of not just being into it, but playing it and writing music, and is quite a storyteller that not only just comes through his visual art, but through many things, and does a lot of work as an advocate to use art as a way to get people to move to different points in their life and to understand things. So welcome, Neil.
Oh, thank you. I feel welcome. Yeah. I think on my Twitter profile, I actually say that I'm a Renaissance man-child.
Is that what
in
it
terms
is?
Of everything that I do and everything I want to do.
I remember seeing something about, and it's so great now that, you know, so much is online, but I remember reading something that, like a little bio, there was different things about you, and it talked about, you know, you're an artist and then just a pretty decent guy.
Yeah, no, that's my
that's
in my email signature as well. It says artist, illustrator, and pretty okay human.
And a pretty
or something
okay
like
human,
that, yeah.
Which is a good place to be.
I try.
Yeah. Well, welcome. We're glad to have you in the area.
Well, thank
and
you.
Glad that we could get you, you know, here at the station today. But let's take a look at, for you, if we go back a bit, when art entered your life? When did that become where it was really an essential part of who you are?
Well, I think I'll actually go before that. I started like really researching a potential career in art when I was in eighth grade. We were given a very basic like, hey, you need to research a career and do a presentation in front of your homeroom class. It was kind of like a time killer, honestly. You know how, like, in eighth grade, they're telling kids to start thinking about their careers in eighth grade, and that's ridiculous. So what I did at the time is I was like, okay, I want to be a photographer. And here's why. Because I want to be Peter Parker. And for those of you who don't know Peter Parker, Spider-Man, yeah. And, like, the first Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie was just out at the time. So I was like, yeah, I'll be Spider-Man. I'll be taking pictures of myself and selling them to the Daily Bugle.
Yeah.
So, like, I researched photography options, and I was like, yeah, you can work at Sears. Or you could be a photojournalist for the AP. You could do this. You could be a fine artist, fine art photographer. And that, like, somehow between then and, like, 6 months later when I was taking this weird class that we had at my middle school where we had different labs that we'd be in for 3 weeks at a time, I had to do a career assignment for that. I was like, I want to be a graphic designer. I don't know how I got onto that, but I just started researching graphic design as a possibility. That went into high school. I found journalism through high school doing illustration and graphic design work. And it was probably my sophomore year or my junior year. It was definitely my junior year of high school where I was actually in the top jazz band at my high school, and we had traveled across the country.
So how did music come into your life? At what point? How old were you?
I was in fifth grade. I had taken piano lessons when my family was still living in Illinois. But fifth grade was when the kids went into band, and I found trombone, and I thought it was the coolest thing ever, and I still think it's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
So I've been playing trombone since I was like 10. But I had kept doing that, and I kept doing it. I was doing marching band, concert band, jazz band, because it was fun. So actually, when I graduated and I told people I was going to art school, they said, oh, for music. And I said, well, actually, I've been doing this thing on the side with illustration and design. And it really caught people by surprise because they didn't know that about me, but it had always been there.
So the outward thing art-wise people knew was the music.
Yes. I was known for my music. But it's because my jazz band at my high school, easily best jazz band in the state, still is. Nebraska jazz bands in high schools. are not nearly at the level as Westside High School. Go Warriors. but like when I was a junior, we went to the Monterey Jazz Festival in Monterey, California.
Oh, very cool.
The next year, we were invited to perform at the National School Board.
How big of a piece went?
Five trombones, six saxophones, five trumpets, four rhythm section.
Oh, good size. Wow.
It was a full big band.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was full big band. The next year, we were invited to perform.
And how old were you when you went to the Monterey, Jeff?
16.
16.
Yeah.
Did you have any sense of what you were going to?
I had known. Like, that's when I was really doing the newspaper a lot.
Okay.
And I had known that, like, art was something that was very important to me. I didn't think music – I never thought music was a good route for me because I didn't take music seriously. I used to work for –
But, when you went to the Monterey Jazz, did you have a sense of where you were – of what that was all about? Because that's a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, we knew.
Like, you did. Okay.
We knew what we were getting ourselves into.
Okay.
We weren't part of the competition, the high school competition. We were invited as an honorary guest, but after hearing the high schools that were competing, they were all California schools.
Ah.
And we were just like, well, that was rude because we're better than half these bands. We definitely weren't the best.
Yeah.
I will say that. I will be the first to say we were not the best. We would not have won that competition, but we were definitely better than a lot of those California schools.
Yeah, but nonetheless, how cool to get to go.
Yeah, it was my first time in California, and it was in the Monterey Bay area. It was really great. We went to an aquarium. I remember that.
Yeah.
Jellyfish.
Yeah.
But yeah, so music and art have always been a very important part of my life, especially just because going to the high school I went to, it was a very well-off high school.
Yeah.
And I was from a single parent who was a school nurse and had I was one of three boys. So it's not necessarily to say that like we were not like we weren't poor by any means, in relative to the rest of the school, I was in social groups where I was the rich kid in one group and I was the poor kid in my jazz band groups.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But like music and art were always important outlets for me.
Yeah.
Because it was a way where I could say that I'm valid, and it was a way where I could remind myself that I'm doing something and that something is worthwhile, even though I'm coming from a completely different area from these honors kids who are like getting tutored and going on to like private schools and stuff like that.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Interesting. So you go, then you head off to college.
Yes. My freshman year in Milwaukee, it was a great experience. That's where I found printmaking, actually. Within 2 weeks, I had known I did not want to be a designer of being up there. And freshman year of art school.
And when you say a designer, like what?
I wanted
to. Like a print designer, you mean? Or?
Yeah. Like I wanted to be an illustrator, design CD covers, T-shirts for bands. I always had music in there somewhere. But like I had that in my mind where I wanted to do that. And then it was seriously like 2 weeks in, I realized that wasn't the path for me. I couldn't work with people. I couldn't work with people in a way where they'd say, I want this, and actually mean something else. Like,
sure.
I didn't want to work like in a client-based design
field.
Yeah,
that wasn't for you. Yeah.
No, it wasn't for me. But I found printmaking because my drawing teacher, Daryl Jensen, was the head of the printmaking department, the print tech. So he made sure all the machines were working and stuff. He was our drawing teacher. And freshman year in any art school is about the same. They're trying to get everybody on the same level. They're talking about design. They make you draw still lives constantly. And so, like, it's not like I was actually in printmaking courses, but through his drawing class, he actually had us do a couple print projects. And that's when I fell in love with printmaking and found it. So when I transferred to UNL,
Let me back you up a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
For people that might – you know, because you hear that word a lot, printmaking. How would you describe what it is?
Printmaking,
really?
Printmaking is an art form for people who don't know what they want to do. So I say that because printmaking is an umbrella term. It captures a lot of different techniques, and it requires a lot of painting skills, and it requires a lot of drawing skills. Most people are aware of screen printing, which is a form of printmaking. T-shirts are printed that way.
Sure.
But also, like, posters are printed that way. Letterpress is also very well known. That's a relief form that people know, where people know about the printing press made by Gutenberg that revolutionized communication, blah, blah, blah. But that's printmaking. That's a form of printmaking that's become more of a finer art because it's obsolete. But also lithography is a form of printmaking that requires stones, limestone. And etching is something that I'm very – I love doing etching. And I etch with copper plates and zinc plates. Involves acid, all sorts of really hardcore fun stuff that I'm trying not to get cancer exposing myself to, hopefully.
Because some of those chemicals are pretty
They're
harsh,
terrible. They're
they?
Scary. And, like, even printmaking ink – pigments like cobalt and cadmium and like all the heavy metal pigments are scary. So I always wear gloves everywhere I go. Even painters should be wearing gloves. All you oil painters out there, you should be wearing gloves. Even watercolor painters should be wearing gloves. Pigments are scary. Anyway, I digress. Printmaking is something that I love because it does allow me to also explore photography, and it allows me to just do whatever I want.
Bring out that Peter Parker in
you. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You feel me? But it allows me, and it also forces me to learn those things. And that's something that's great for me because, like I said, Renaissance Manchild, I'm interested in doing so many different things that printmaking just fit me so well. It really did.
Yeah. Yeah, because of so much that was involved in that. You know, and I think, too, when you're seeking, the more choices you have, the more you can work with.
Yeah.
You know, the more focus you can get. I mean, as odd as that sounds sometimes.
No. You know? Because printmaking doesn't, like, pertain to a specific aesthetic. Like, painting has – painting works against gravity. So, like, drips are a thing in painting. Splatters are a thing in painting. And that can happen in printmaking, but you can also be very precise and very drawing. Like, M.C. Escher's prints were lithographs, and they look like charcoal drawings. And so you can have that effect. You can mess with analog photography and do that with a lithography or etching. So, like, the nice thing about printmaking is that it opens you to, like, any form of aesthetic.
Yeah.
And then there are print artists who create objects out of their prints. And now 3D printing is part of printmaking, and digital printing is part of printmaking.
Yeah.
And the technology is amazing that it's mixing brand new technology with centuries old technology. It's just invigorating. It really is. It's constantly inspiring me.
Yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but you're in college.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the part we're talking about, not right now.
Yeah.
But because what intrigues me about you is that you have so many different art forms that have been that you've been involved with and involved with you know, throughout your life so far. In college, you got very much into writing through being a part of the newspaper for the university.
Yeah.
And how did that come about for you?
I asked nicely.
had you spent time writing, just writing?
Actually, yeah. In high school, I was working as the graphics editor for my newspaper, but I decided one day in October that I wanted to write an article. And so I told my editor, hey, I'm going to write an opinion column if you have space. And they're like, okay, kid who doesn't write for our newspaper.
Yeah.
So I wrote this article, and it was about coming out day in October. And in the article, I came out. And I was like, hello, West Side, I'm gay.
Yeah.
And it was
– And was that something that your mom – you guys had already had the discussion or no?
She knew. Okay. She wasn't very happy that I did that.
Okay.
She didn't know that I did that until the day the article came out, and we had quite the fight and struggle with that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that article went on to get me into state journalism competition for column writing. So this non-writer got sixth place in writing, and I thought that was hilarious. I was also one of two students from Nebraska to win the National Quill and Scroll Award for writing in journalism from Nebraska. The other one ended up
being
my – That's
why you were in college?
That's why I was in high school.
In high school, okay.
The other one being Bob Algreen, who I ended up actually working with on the Daily Nebraskan, which was hilarious that, like, it's so a small world.
Yeah.
And so, like, years later, I was like, hey, we won the same award one year. What's up?
Yeah. But you carried that into college.
Yeah,
then,
yeah. I told my editor, I was like, hey, I won these awards when I was in high school. Can I write a music column? I want to write a music column from the experience as a musician, because there were already plenty of entertainment columns, and I wanted to write about being a musician and what that's like. And actually what happened was about 2 weeks after I got that column in the summer edition. It was a summer edition, which was allowed to be a little bit more experimentatious, if that even a word. Anyway, about 2 weeks after that, the band that I had started when I was in high school that I moved back to Lincoln in order to be a part of kicked me out. So I was like, well, there goes my article. So what I ended up writing it as is I ended up just being like, okay, I was a musician and I know what it's like to be on tour. I know what it's like. Let's talk about pop culture. Let's talk about like, let's talk about Katy Perry. Let's talk about Childish Gambino, the rap persona of Donald Glover. Let's talk about like these like big names and what their actual implications are and what it means to be like a small time, no one's ever heard of me musician writing about these big name musicians. So that's what it ended up becoming.
Yeah.
But yeah, I asked nicely. I was working as an illustrator for the paper at the time and eventually assistant art director before becoming art director. And I just said, hey, I want to write a weekly column. And it became a thing where I was seriously, I made sure that I worked every night my article was due because I didn't write it until I got there. So it'd be like 5 o'clock and my article Chance would just say, hey, my editor Chance would say, hey, where's your article? And I'll be like, typing, I got it, there you go. And then I would come up with the idea there. Or sometimes I was like, hey, sorry, no article tonight. And the designers were behind me and they always yell at me for that because then they'd have to figure out how to make the page work without an article by me.
But the music, you brought some music in with you.
I did.
Can we listen to the one that you – from a band you were in since we were talking
about?
Oh,
sure, yeah, track two.
Which is track two we're going to go to, mm-hmm. Cecil. And that was a band called We Are the Union.
Yes.
Was that the band you got kicked out of?
No, we won't even mention that band.
Okay, all right.
We Are the Union is a band, I guess, technically still. They're on hiatus, but they're playing a couple festivals this year without me. Reed.
Yeah.
But they're originally from the Detroit area of Michigan. I got into that band through an audition from another band I was in, and I played trombone, like, because that's the best instrument I know. It's the instrument I'm actually trained in. It's this fast punk ska. I like to call it very angry, but also very melodic. There's lots of vocal harmonies. There's a lot of musicality to it.
Do you sing?
I do.
Okay.
And I sang backup, not on this record. I actually didn't record this record, but I wanted to. I was going to, but I didn't. But I would sing a lot of Reed's harmonies when I was in this band. And this band, I was on tour for about 3 months in 2012 after I graduated college. I had got a job as a professional framer with my BFA, and I hated every minute of it. Yeah. I was working for a big-name arts and crafts store that I won't name. And I was making picture frames, and I hated it. And then I got this audition, and I was like, bye, guys. I'm going to leave this decently paying job to make $10 a day in a van. Go to Canada and have fun with that. It was a great experience though because I learned so much on that tour. I have a story about that tour after we listen to the song.
Well,
I'll tell you about Canada.
Yeah. This is the song is Dust in the Hourglass, and this is We Are the Union. right. From Ann Arbor, Detroit, that band.
Technically Ann Arbor, but let's just say Detroit because it strokes their egos
a little bit more. That was the band We Are the Union. That was their song Dust in the Hourglass of Fear. Just joining us, my guest in the studio today, Neil Oriens, a visual artist. We've been talking about printmaking, but also has been involved in music, too, in his life, and is currently we have him here today because he is currently a guest teaching artist at the Delta Grand and Opelousas for their youth summer art camp. So we were lucky enough to pull him in today. I'm curious, listening to that, and you were out touring with these guys, and visual art and printmaking is such a big part of your life. When you're involved in different art forms, does one art form ever sidetrack the other, or do you stay involved in both kind of equally?
I think right now I'm at a point where I'm starting to marry them a little bit better. But there was a long time where what I was doing in art was radically different than what I was doing in music.
How so, when you say
I was just kind of in undergrad, I was just kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I was so afraid of working with queer issues because I didn't want to be labeled.
Okay.
I was so afraid of that. I was so afraid of just being like, well, he's doing the easy thing because that's his life. So I just stayed away from that.
And I mean, terms of themes of artwork that you were putting
themes out? Themes and research.
And writing and research.
And
okay.
All of that. I was terrified of it. And then also, I don't think any of my professors knew. I don't think I was flamboyant enough for them. So I feel like part of that, too, I felt like maybe they just either wouldn't take it as sincere. And then I would have to, like, come out to them and say, like, no, this is real. And it's Nebraska. It just is. It's Nebraska. As much as they like to pretend to be very progressive and a very progressive program, it's still Nebraska.
Okay.
So there was I felt very stifled. So then it wasn't until very recently after undergrad that I really started investigating queer ideas. And I talk a lot about anxiety as like the raw motivation for my work. And that has also, like, fueled a lot of my music in that, like, the stuff that I write is very – I notice that the better things that I write, the things that I really feel are good songs, are things that I write about myself and things I write about my experience and things I write about struggling with, like, an internal argument. So it was – I was doing that stuff in music, and I was doing something completely different in art. And eventually – I think I really am at a point where I'm starting to marry a lot of my ideas together.
Yeah.
But it's also just like I feel as an artist, it's kind of hard to go to the program that I went to and be like into like ska and be into punk, and all these kids are listening to complete indie stuff. The radio program that was from the radio station that was through the university, their catchphrase is "Get Indied." So they have this indie mindset, and they're bringing in indie bands and stuff like that. And I'm completely in left field listening to like all these popular bands from the 90s. So it just felt weird to like be like, I'm doing this art that's very modern and contemporary, but my music tastes are like completely different from my program, so I don't fit in as a result. It was weird. It was a weird situation. But
now I
feel like I'm really starting to kind of just say like just kind of not care.
Yeah.
And really just do what I want to do.
Exactly. You know, you mentioned about anxiety. Mm-hmm. With music or with the visual art, those art forms, did they become methods that you used to address some of the anxiety issues that you were experiencing?
It's catharsis, really.
Okay.
It genuinely is. Performing on stage with a group of like five other guys is probably the most cathartic experience I've ever, especially that music. Oh my goodness. I was able to be so angry and get a lot of like pent up frustration out. And then I was able to do that every single night for 3 months.
Yeah.
But it's cathartic, and being able to, I'm currently.
A healing time
it
for
is.
You.
It is. It really is. And like, I don't want to say it's therapeutic because then people are like, oh, you do art therapy. I don't. Yeah. But I'm currently working on this series. I was working on it before I came here when I was working on my solo show, Nothing Is Fine, But I Swear That It's All Right. that I had in Omaha before coming to Louisiana. I was working on this series, just trying to get work out, and I realized that it was a lot different than what I was making for the show, and that's because it was actually a response to this situation I'm in right now, where I have an ex that I care for very deeply who has suicidal thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to keep him away from that. I'm trying to be a positive light. And I realize that I'm like, I'm embroidering these things. And I'm just coming up with things that are on the top of my head. So I'm embroidering words on top of abstractions. And then one day I just looked at the words that I'm going. I'm like, oh my goodness, I know exactly who this is about. I'm making this kind of work. I'm expressing this. I had another series called Cathartic Memory that was about a bad breakup I had last year. I had, like, all these different things where I'm just, like, allowing myself to just do something.
Exactly. Like, you know, and it's interesting you bring up about the titles of some of your work. Because, like, no, this show that you just had, it was in Omaha, that nothing is fine, but I swear that it's all right.
Yeah.
You know?
That is the...
That's a good title.
That is the opening lyric to a chorus of a local band from Lincoln called the JV All-Stars, who are my friends. I was in another band with some of them. Almost all of my titles I rip from lyrics, which is another way that I try to, like, marry the two. That's what I've been doing lately, and I've been doing it with songs mostly from bands that, like, I'm friends with. I try not to, like, do, like, popular bands.
Well, and then in some of your current work that you have, and if people are interested in finding out more about Neil, you can go to Neil, and that's N-E-I-L, makesthings.com. But I noticed some of the titles that you have for some of your visual art, See Through the Exterior.
That's another JVA lyric.
We fall apart at our own pace.
That's a band called Iron Sheik. I know all of these.
But that's great to know. I didn't know that's where these came from.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't really make a case for Stain.
Also,
you know?
Iron Sheik.
Yeah, I get it. I don't regret it. So that's fabulous. So that's where you're getting the titles for your visual
work. And, like, part of it is because it's a joke to me, but also it's because that's what I'm listening to when I'm creating.
When you're creating.
Yeah. And it's something I identify with so much. That song is an amazing song by this band called Iron Sheik. It's called Every Town Has an Elm Street, and it's about leaving your hometown. And, like, the person who's singing is basically saying, like, I couldn't make a case for staying. Like,
sure.
Like, I'm not right and you're not right. I will let you do what you want to do, but I'm going to miss you.
Yeah.
And, like, that's a huge theme in a lot of the music that I listen to, is hating your hometown and wanting to leave. And now I'm doing that. So it, I just identified with it so strongly. And with that series was about not feeling at home in Omaha or Lincoln or Nebraska in general.
Well, and it's interesting, and I said sometimes with visual art on the radio, but, you know, the best we can describe it, it's interesting when you look at your work because there is a picture behind there's a scene or like a picture you see, and then there's these geometric, you know, shapes that are in the front. And as I looked at them, it was almost like the geometric shapes were the being or the person. That's how I saw that and how they were interacting with whatever that was, that scene was going on.
Yeah, a lot of the geometrics and abstractions I do are actually based off of a practice that I inherited from my mom, which sometimes I include in my artist statement, where she scribbles on the side of the margin of a paper. I see it on a lot of her things where she's doing facts and figures for money. She'll, like, scribble something, and she'll, like, make a frame out of, like, a thing where she'll have, like, my budget for this son is this, and she'll, like, frame it, and she'll just, like, neurotically do that. And I got that from her, in that I do that, like, on papers, and I do that when I'm nervous. But I do a very different thing where I'm not framing things, I'm just doodling. So, like, a lot of those shapes mean different things for me.
That's interesting. That's where that came from, though.
Yeah.
From watching your mom do that.
Yeah, yeah. It was one day I realized that that's where I inherited it from.
Yeah,
it wasn't
like
I watched her and I emulated it. It was just like one day I was like, oh my goodness, I am like my mother.
Yeah.
Hi, Mom, if you're listening.
That's where that came from. Yeah. And so, I mean, the way that you're putting the different, it's not really pieces together, but with the background of those pieces that are currently on your site, is photographs, is paint?
I think what you're referring to are photographs.
Okay.
They're digitally printed off on BFK, which is a cotton-based paper, which has a lot of give. It lets you print on it. I screen printed on a lot of them. I cut them out. I collage on top of them. I stitch on top of them. It allows you to do things to it, and it's very just forgiving to a certain extent.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. Please check out the website for podcasts. You can catch up on shows that you haven't heard. Just a great wealth of locally produced programs here at the station. And as I always say, tip of the hat to you folks who do help us support this station, because we are listener supported and are a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Makes it pretty easy to go to the website and you'll see a donate button. So please continue to help us with what we do here.
I don't mean to take in charge of my own interview,
but you
mentioned donating, and I have lots of nonprofit experience. Can we talk about some of the nonprofit stuff that I do? Is that okay?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we'll get to that.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
I promised people.
Because it really is an important thing.
Yeah.
I want to go back, though. My guest in the studio is Neil Oriens, and he's an artist from Omaha, Nebraska, actually on his way to through a stop off in Opelousas to teach art at a young people's camp at the Delta Grand, but then is heading to UConn, to the University of Connecticut, to go work on his MFA. One thing I want to talk about, though, is your involvement that you did with – I'm really interested in this organization, and it was the Union for Contemporary Art.
Yes.
In Omaha.
Yes.
And it talks about the Union for Contemporary Art is committed to strengthening the creative culture of the greater Omaha area by providing direct support to artists and increasing the visibility of contemporary art forms in our community. In every endeavor, we strive to unite artists and the community to inspire positive social change in mm-hmm. North Omaha. Now, that was a program where you got a fellowship there.
Yes.
That you had to be juried in.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that experience with that program.
Yeah. So for 6 months at the Union, I had a studio on site in North Omaha.
And what brought you to them?
It was actually through another nonprofit that I worked for and volunteered for, called Inclusive Communities. The executive director, Beth Riley, knew Brigitte Hsu, who is the executive director for the Union. All nonprofit people know each other.
Sure.
Especially
right.
in Omaha. In Omaha, it's a very tight-knit community.
And it's like that around here, too.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. So we had a reunion event for our programming, where we have programming for high school students, and it was at the Union because we wanted them to get out of West Omaha or Central Omaha. So we went to North Omaha at the Union, and then I saw this studio space, and I was like, well, dang, this is awesome. I want to come here. So I applied for their fellowship program.
And what did you have to do for that? You had to submit work?
Submit work and some writing and a couple references. The first time I had visited there, actually, a person I went to high school with was a fellow, and then someone who got an MFA from the college I got my BFA at, they were both fellows. And I said, well, these are recognizable names. This must mean something. This must be something that's worth investigating.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was, and I applied, and I was accepted, thankfully.
And how long were you involved with that organization?
6 months.
For 6 months?
With my fellowship, yeah, 6 months.
And so and do they have a program that they lay out, or what do you do once you become a fellow? Because it really was intriguing to me about everything they do.
So as a fellow, I got an honorarium to make work and the studio space that I had 24-hour access to. But in exchange of that, I had to offer some sort of service project. A lot of artists will work for Habitat for Humanity in North Omaha. North Omaha is a wonderful, wonderful community that has been forgotten by the rest of the city.
Yeah.
It lacks infrastructure. It lacks a lot of basic access to things like when the power goes out in Omaha, North Omaha is the last to be serviced, stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah.
And then North Omaha also happens to be, as part of historic systems, happens to be where a lot of the Black community of Omaha lives. So it's kind of just like, wow, great, institutional racism. North Omaha, like I said, is beautiful. It has the Malcolm X Center. Malcolm X was born in Omaha. Not too many people know about that. It has a great jazz history place. And now it has the Union. It has this amazing historical and contemporary culture that's just blooming. And Creighton University is also located near North Omaha. Not quite. I wouldn't say Creighton is in North Omaha, but it's close. North Omaha needs the Union, and they're doing great work because they're connecting artists with the
and vice versa.
Oh, definitely.
It sounds like the Union needs North Omaha.
Yeah, but it's such a great relationship that they have, because there are kids who come in, and this summer they offered free art classes for kids. And so the kids were coming in there doing projects. They just recently opened a printmaking studio. So kids are learning about printmaking. And, of course, this wasn't there when I was there.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Brigitte and Josh and Paige are doing amazing, amazing work for North Omaha. And I'm so happy to be a part of it.
That's really a wonderful concept that they're doing, that they're providing, you know, artists the opportunity mm-hmm. to create, but then also that piece about giving back.
Yeah. So
you know?
I was allowed to basically do whatever I wanted. So that's actually what We Are Here is from. We Are Here is my fellowship project. And We Are Here is this project that I started at the union where I was actually given – I love the union so much. It gave me the opportunity to really marry my advocacy experience with my art and finally just be like, you know what? I'm just doing this.
Yeah.
So I came up with this project where
because
I wanted –
because that's what they're all about.
Pretty
yeah,
much, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah.
I mean, I could have worked for Habitat for Humanity.
Sure.
I could have come up with other projects, but I decided this. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to give a voice to queer youth in Omaha to begin with. And I wanted to give them the ability to tell their own story in their own words through art. And I had actually originally wanted to do this project through the Anti-Defamation League of the Midlands. They had this public art project that I was not accepted for. But when I got the union thing, I was like, well, here we go. Let's do this.
Yeah.
So what I did was I took portraits of these youth and I asked them, here's my email address. Send me your story. Tell me who you are. Tell me about your queer identity. So I would do these portraits. I would read their stories, and I would base their portraits, their abstractions, everything that I did on it off of their stories. So my friend Drew was one of the first to submit this story, and he talked about his grandmother when he came out handing him a book that was about how homosexuality is terrible and it's a sin. And she actually knew that he was busy, so she highlighted the important segments and ear-leafed it. So on his portrait, I have these yellow lines over his face.
That represents, sure.
Yeah, and I had another person come up to me who is currently transitioning from female to male. So his portrait, I actually used the geometric form of testosterone as a chemical and used that on top of it. They're kind of like obscure, like you have to know what's going on in the portrait. But what I then did with these portraits is I screen printed a lot of them with a little QR code, which you could scan with your phone and go to the website where it had their story written in their own words. And I had friends coming back to me, friends who are currently closeted or...
And where were these so that they could scan the...
I had boxes that I pasted a lot of the prints onto, but then I...
Like big cardboard, what you're talking about?
They're about 10 by 10 by 10.
Okay.
Small little baby cardboard boxes to begin with.
Yeah.
And then I also printed them off on Xerox and hung them up in local businesses and coffee shops. I did this in October of 2013, and there are still posters up in Drastic Plastic, this store downtown. And you can scan it. You can go read their story. It's still up. But then I also did a larger scale installation. Drew Heckman, the founder of the Queer Nebraska Youth Networks, came to me, and we worked on this Coming Out Day event in October of last year. And I did these large scale portraits of them on big, big boxes. I think they're 48 by 52 was the actual measurement. But for those, I took off the QR codes and I just had the stories pasted onto them.
Okay.
And that was something that I struggled with about the idea, is that I love the idea of using technology to merge a very Luddite technology of printmaking. I love that concept, like from a contemporary art standpoint, but it was also an access issue in that not everybody has access to a QR scanner. So that's kind of like an entire population I'm leaving out of it. So I figured it would be better if I just had them able to read them.
Sure.
So I had these large scale boxes in the middle of the old market-ish in Omaha on ConAgra's campus. Actually, ConAgra is based in Omaha. They have their headquarters there. So we had the Chef Boyardee statue behind us. And we had all these different LGBTQ organizations that were supportive, or their organizations that work, or like the public library, stuff like that. That just like
that's
saying,
a visual though with the Chef Boyardee.
Yeah.
Statue,
oh, it's great. We were gonna put a boa on it. Drew's dad used to work for a division of ConAgra, so that's kind of how we got the space.
It was
a great connection that we made there. But Chef Boyardee.
What were the young people's? What was their feedback to you about being involved in that program?
I had a friend come to me who was closeted, and I'm pretty sure she still is, because of her culture is very unaccepting of it. She's expected to marry a man from her region where she's from.
Sure.
And she came to me and she thanked me so much for the opportunity just to think about it, and because no one had ever asked her those questions.
Yeah,
no one had asked her what it's like. What does it mean? And there's this sentence in her story that makes me cry every time because I know her so well, and it's about being wanting to be out. That parents should support and love their children, give them hugs, and not make them feel suffocated.
Yeah,
and that's what a lot of queer youth go through. Especially in the Midwest. And now I'm moving to a region where it's very much more accepting. But it was important for me to give queer youth the opportunity to tell their own stories. I didn't want them to be statistics. I didn't want them to be just numbers or faces. I wanted them to have a story and to tell it in their own words. So I want to continue working on this project. It became a thing where I was working on grad school applications and I kind of lost a little bit of momentum in it, but I want to continue working on it in grad school, open it up a little bit more, have multimedia aspects with it. I really want to do video interviews, do some projectional work type. But I still want to continue the non-destructive street art aspect of it because I think that's really important. And it's a really great way to broadcast it in a way where the conversation is about the content and the conversation is about like that kind of a dialogue as opposed to just ethics of street art, whether or not it's okay.
Well, and then I always look at the access value of that. You know, people who may not necessarily, you know, let's say you did that inside a museum,
yeah,
you know, or an art gallery. There's a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily go walk in there for whatever reason.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think, you know, just providing access to things that we all need to pay attention to and think about.
One of the projects I want to expand upon this too when I get up to Connecticut is I want to have conversations with recently transitioned or currently homeless queer adults and youth.
Yeah.
And talk about that struggle because of youth who are homeless, 1 in 4 are queer identified, and that is very disproportional to how many queer identified people there are. So many of them are homeless because their parents kicked them out.
Sure.
And I want to see, like, I want them to have the opportunity to tell their stories in a way that isn't very, like homeless art is tends to be very, oh, look at this. This is homeless, the blah, blah, blah. I want it to be in a way where they're telling their own stories and they're not just like it's not voyeuristic.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to tell their own stories. I want them to have dignity while doing it. And I want to humanize homeless people. So that's something I'm considering writing about and researching a little bit about. I have all these project outlines on my computer right now for what I want to do in Connecticut.
Yeah.
I'm very excited for the opportunity.
Oh, fabulous. Well, we're going to take a short break. Should we listen? You want to listen to the song you brought in by Tally Hall?
Sure. Another Ann Arbor, Michigan-based band.
That's track one.
Yep.
Duncan.
Tally Hall.
Or Duncan. Why am I thinking?
Duncan.
Cecil. We were talking about Duncan earlier with his set design. tell us about Tally Hall.
Tally Hall is a band that has been a part of my life since I was in high school. And something I didn't tell you about was in Omaha, Nebraska, there was this ordinance that was passed that certain music venues where they have a certain percentage of alcohol sales, minors are not allowed to be there unless they have a parental consent form on file at each venue. So it's not even like the whole city. You have to have it at each venue. And that was passed around the time I became 18. And that was a huge access issue for me because I was this little punk kid who was going to all these punk shows and suddenly I couldn't anymore.
Yeah.
But Tally Hall played on my 18th birthday at a bar. It was their only Nebraska date that I know of. And they sang me happy birthday. It was great. But this band has been a part of my life. I love their first album that they released. The reason why I love it so much is because every single track seems like it's a different genre.
Yeah.
So they have like this beautifully orchestrated vocal parts, and then they have a song about being in love with Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen and trying to navigate that. And then they have a rap song, and then they used to do a cover of Just a Friend by Biz Markie. They used to do that, and it was great. It was fantastic. It was really well done.
Yeah.
So Tally Hall has always been important to me. They broke up a couple of years ago, but also it's that Michigan connection.
Sure, exactly.
That, like, my life has somehow revolved around me being in Michigan. I don't know why, but it has.
Yeah.
So when I brought this up to my friends in We Are the Union, they're like, you really like Tally Hall? Seriously? And I was like, I'm sorry.
Yes. Well, this is you and me, the band Tally Hall.
Starting out the road, carefully unload, open second night and all the light is falling. Back and forth, and I can see it, of course. Maybe I am in the way, recalling it's just you. Off again we go, another seat to sew, another part to keep in proper order. What have I begun? Get away undone. I have seen the signs and I ignored them. Now it's you and me, divine, a circular design. Do-do-do-do. Time and place in mind, points along the line. Do-do-do-do. Sitting in the park, carefully remark.
Tally Hall and the song You and Me, and that is a band from
Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Ann Arbor, Michigan. Yep. And Rob Cantori is the lead singer of that band.
And he has a solo album out.
All right.
Yeah. He's a great guy.
You can check that out, too. If you're just joining me, my guest in the studio today, Neil Oriens, is a you know, you're here. I found myself, I almost just said Orleans, like New Orleans.
When I was growing up, New Orleans would always like correct itself and spell check on the old computers. It was always New Orleans. It's funny.
Yeah, your name, like, Neil Oriens.
Yeah, now I have a very strong Cajun connection.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
That's great.
Now that I'm engaged to a Cajun, like, yeah. it's great.
Yeah, there you are. We were talking a bit, Neil, about this organization, the Union for Contemporary Art in Omaha. Mm-hmm. And you also talked a little bit, you were mentioning about the Bemis.
Yes, the Bemis Center of Contemporary Art is, it offers artist residencies. And it's one of the best residency programs in the country, honestly.
And is that connected to a university, or they're a freestanding?
No, they're freestanding. But they have like just a lot of donors. But it's one of the best programs because it's live-in studio space. So you get a stipend, and then you also live in your studio space.
Oh, very cool.
And it's... it's hundreds and hundreds of applications every year to get like 20 spots.
And is that studio space, is it connected actually to the art center? You know, to the building, or is it a separate like warehouse building or something?
Before I really knew downtown Omaha that well, I would say it's out of the way, but it's not really out of the way. It's connected, I would say. Honestly, my experience with the Omaha art scene is still very limited. There's only so much I know about it. Being kind of like well-bred in Lincoln and then moving back to Omaha.
Sure. But the person who started the Union for Contemporary Art,
Brigitte,
came out of that.
Yeah, she had actually this really great gallery space called the Bemis Underground, where they had local artists. They would have them have shows, and it was a way to like kind of get them recognized. So she had been running that and doing that, and then she was like, you know what? I'm going to do this instead. And she made this amazing organization that does really great work that's based out of what used to be a food pantry and the Omaha Catholic Charities.
Oh, that's what the union was.
It used to be a food pantry. Yeah, okay. They just recently got rid of the refrigerator. People would actually still come up to the building because they didn't change their website that's no longer a food pantry.
Yeah. But what a great repurposing of a
definitely,
you know,
yeah.
of a building that
and
was
they have
there.
Garden space too. They have garden space that they offer free vegetables to people. And North Omaha is a bit of a food desert, so that's a very important thing for people up there to be able to get like freshly grown organic food. That's amazing for them.
Yeah, it's a great mission that they have. That's fabulous. You know that I mean they offer that with the gardening, then they. You know, the folks that come to spend time
and the
there.
Tool library. How could I forget the tool library? People can sign up to always have access to tools, which is something –
like to art tools or
– regular saws,
oh, really?
Shovels, hammers.
Ah.
That is a huge access problem in North Omaha. Shell, I think his last name is Peterson. Please don't hate me if I get your last name wrong, Shell. He started it when he was a fellow and then worked it. And like that was his project.
That was his project.
Yeah, his project was this tool library. And now people can check out tools. And if they don't know how to use them, they are able to teach them and help them. And that just helps, like, even with, like, basic infrastructure, like fixing a house.
Exactly.
Which there's no Lowe's, there's no Menards, which is a Midwest thing. There's no, like, Home Depot in North Omaha.
Yeah.
So, like, to be able to do that is just is great. It's such a great resource for North Omaha. And I say this a lot. I'm really happy to be a part of it and, like, to be associated with it.
Yeah, because my guess is a place like that, once you're a fellow, you're always, like, connected.
Yeah, and I'm forever grateful for it.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm curious, too, if they have seen people continue to, like, come back and give back.
Definitely.
You know, to the place. It
Definitely.
Seems like one of those.
One of the first cycle of fellows, they were a documentary team that did urban gardening. And I cannot remember the name of the documentary right now, but they just released it.
Yeah.
And they had their start off at the union and through like Kickstarter and all that. That helped too.
Sure.
And then one of the other fellows, Victoria Hoyt, she got her MFA at UNL. She's still very involved. I might be mistaken in saying she's a board member now, but I've seen her at board meetings at least. Totally giving back.
Yeah,
and
it's great.
It instills a passion in people, and that's great. That's so important.
You know, and it would be interesting, and maybe this is done, but to really see what, you know, the fellows that end up there for their artwork initially, you know, to pursue, you know, something in their artwork. It'd be interesting to see if there's changes that occur in style or direction.
For me, definitely.
What did you see?
I have a direction in my work. My research in queer theory, I'm researching masculinity in queer identities and what that means. I would never have started that. And even mixing advocacy and art, I never would have done that if it had not been for the union. So like I will always say that the Union for Contemporary Art got me into grad school and got me assistantship and they're the reason, honestly. I cannot stress enough how important it is that people – I think every single artist always has to somehow ask the question in their career, why do I make art when there are people starving? And whether that answer is I give back with my art or it doesn't matter, I just make art, it doesn't matter. I think every artist needs to ask themselves that question at some
because
point in their career.
Why?
Because people are starving. because I think it's important that we recognize in our society.
Versus other career paths asking the same question.
I think it's important. Honestly, I think everybody should ask it.
Okay.
But I think
okay.
it's especially important for art because I think artists in our society forget that what they do is to a certain extent frivolous. Art is not necessary to life. You don't need art in order to eat and live and survive. I mean, people would argue, yes, you do. But like, if we're getting at like the raw biology of it, you don't need art to run an economy. To really do that.
It'd be interesting to hear feedback we might get on that.
Oh yeah, people are going to hate me for saying that.
Yeah.
But I think it's important that every artist at least addresses that at some point. Why do I make art when there are people starving? And it doesn't necessarily mean every artist needs to be an advocate. Not every artist needs to be an activist. I'm not saying that.
Sure.
I'm just saying I found my way to negotiate that. And that is through helping people express themselves, helping people talk about themselves, helping people find their stories. And I think every single artist needs to somehow figure that out. And like theater artists can do it. They can give back to the community. They can teach workshops. Writers can totally do it. Writers can help people tell their stories.
Yeah, me too. That's right.
Or even just like, I sell a bunch of work. I'm going to donate to this really cool nonprofit. That's totally valid too. But I think every single person needs to do that. My brother works for retail. I think he needs to do that. My older brother works for systems for a university. He needs to figure out like, why is he doing that? Websites are not necessary when there are people who are struggling even in this country to eat and to live, and there are homeless people. Like, everybody just needs to address it. Everybody needs to figure out why they do what they do and how they can give back.
And I think a lot of people can find in what they do something that connects to it that does serve the greater good.
Totally. Everybody can do it.
That's
everybody,
right.
Like, no one needs to wait before helping the world. And that's Anne Frank kind of said that. But, like, everybody has the opportunity to help.
Well, there is a note to end on, Neil. Neil Oriens, it's been a pleasure having you here today.
Thank you.
I'm glad you passed through our area.
Me too.
And good luck at UConn.
Thank you.
Beautiful part of the country up there.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be fun to see what comes out of you
in
the
you.
Next
Thank
couple
you.
Of years. We are going to go out with a song by Andrew Wong.
Yes.
And this is Walk Into the Light. Have a good week, everybody.
Dirty Rice on the air every Saturday evening from 8:30 to 10 p.m. Join either Mr. Lee Klein, Peter, or myself, Bill Bolins, for a program of great Louisiana music. That's Dirty Rice, Saturday nights, 8:30 to 10, with a rebroadcast at noon on Wednesday, right here on KRVS 88.7 FM and on the internet at krvs.org.
Hello. This is John Green, host of Night Train Jazz, inviting you to tune in every Tuesday from 8 to 10 for 2 hours of the very latest recorded jazz, as well as a sprinkling of oldies but goodies. That's Night Train, Tuesdays from 8 to 10 here on KRVS 88.7 FM in Lafayette and Lake Charles.